From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Korean Context, news and analysis from the Korean Peninsula. Hello, and welcome to Korean Context. I'm your host, Jenna Gibson. This week, we are going to be touching on one of the most talked about issues when it comes to the Korean Peninsula, which is, of course, North Korea, what to do about them, and whether sanctions are really the most effective tool in our toolkit to create change within the North Korean regime. So to talk about this, we're here with Dr. Dersen Peksin. He is an associate professor of political science at the University of Memphis. Dr. Peksin has published several articles and has some more articles forthcoming on economic sanctions, armed interventions, human rights, political violence, and democratization. So this is a very topical issue that we're going to be talking about with him today. And I also have to mention, of course, that Dr. Peksin just published an article for KEI entitled Authoritarian Regimes and Economic Sanction Effectiveness, the Case of North Korea. So I'm really excited to get down to it. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So we just had our program where you were talking about your article and you were talking about whether or not sanctions are the most effective tool for use against North Korea. One of the things that I noticed during your presentation that was very interesting is you had a diagram that compared how sanctions are supposed to work versus how they have been working generally and in the case of North Korea. Could you start by giving us kind of that broad picture there?
Sure. So my intention was to sort of, when I showed these two different figures, my goal was to compare how we think sanctions may work versus how sanctions actually operate in practice. So if you look at the traditional understanding of sanctions, scholars and policymakers expect that sanctions would work in most cases if they can impair the coercive capacity of the targeted regimes and generate some contention and anti-government protests in targeted countries, right? If sanctions are able to inflict major damage on the target economy, the expectation is, according to the traditional understanding of sanctions, is that the regime will lack enough coercive capacity to be able to maintain the status quo, and more economic damage and growing economic instabilities and distress in target countries should also create more protests and contention against the regime that will eventually force the regime to give in to external pressure. That's what traditionally, we expect sanctions to work. But my argument is that sanctions don't often work how they are expected to. Instead, I offered an alternative explanation that suggests that sanctions tend to fail against targeted regimes because targeted leaders are able to survive sanctions using two major domestic policies, including repression and positive inducements or selective rewards, right? I'm not suggesting that domestic policies or the domestic strategies, the two domestic strategies that I am talking about, are the only factors that affect the success rate of sanctions. But my main argument is that these are among the most influential factors that affect the ineffectiveness, the failed record of sanctions against authoritarian regimes, including North Korea. So according to my own alternative explanation of how sanctions operate in practice, my first contention is that sanctions don't impair the coercive capacity of the regime as policymakers or scholars tend to assume. Regimes are able to evade the cost of sanctions. Regimes are able to sort of divert the cost of sanctions to average citizens while using the remaining economic resources to protect or to insulate their ruling coalition from the adverse effect of sanctions, right? So if that's the case, if sanctions are unable to undermine the coercive capacity of the regime, there is no incentive for a targeted leader to concede to external pressures, right? My second point related to the first one is that sanctions do not also generate or do not trigger violence and anti-government protests as policymakers tend to expect in sanctioning countries, right? This is in part because sanctioned regimes are inclined to use repressive means when they face any major domestic potential opposition, right? This point is related to my first one, because if regimes are able to suppress opposition because their coercive capacity is usually intact, which suggests that they can use their existing power to be able to eliminate any potential changes to their authority. So overall, my argument is that sanctions don't work in most cases, especially when they are targeted against authoritarian regimes, because regimes are able to survive them using repression and offering selective goods to their key supporters to be able to maintain the status quo and order.
Right. I think it's really interesting because we hear a lot more about sanctions lately. And you talked about in your presentation about the last few decades, sanctions have actually been used more and more. So I guess my question then is, if we haven't really seen so much success with sanctions, or we haven't seen their coercive power being as strong as we think they should be, how is there this disconnect between using them more, even though they're not really working?
Sanctions are considered maybe a happy medium between the use of force and diplomacy. So if you think about sort of three main ways that we could deal with a regime that conflicts with us, right? One option is to use of force, but military interventions or armed forces are not too popular, in part because there's not enough public support for them. They tend to be politically costly for policymakers, hence they are usually not inclined to use force, right, in most cases. Hence, sanctions are considered less costly because we are only using nonviolent economic tools to impose them. But at the same time, diplomacy could be another option. The diplomacy is not as appealing as sanctions, in part because they sometimes considered as cheap talk or an ineffective tool to induce any major policy change from targeted regimes. So sanctions are popular in part because they are sort of an appealing option to policymakers in the U.S. and other countries.
So to get into kind of the nitty-gritty of the North Korean case, applying your theory here, it makes a lot of sense to me, at least, that the North Korean regime is insulated from some of the negative effects of sanctions, in terms of they're able to put it off onto the people, they're able to get around it in certain ways. And in your presentation, you discussed some of the ways that they're able to circumvent the sanctions regime. So can you give us a little more detail there?
Sure. So to be clear, North Korea has been under several rounds of economic sanctions since 1950, since the beginning of the Korean War. So the sanctions during the Cold War were mostly comprehensive sanctions that denied North Korean access to Western economies. In the post-Cold War era, in the early 1990s, we observed a shift in the design of economic sanctions. The UN and US-led sanctions were more selective, more targeted or smart sanctions that try to put the pressure on the elites of target regimes rather than the population in general, right? So what we know about the sanctions against North Korea is that the regime has been able to survive sanctions in part because of its ability to keep its ruling coalition intact, right? So when we look at the nature of a political regime in North Korea, it's a leader-centric regime with established institutions. So the regime essentially is controlled by a small coalition of Workers' Party members, top bureaucrats, and key military officers. So there is a relatively small coalition of people that are in charge of the country, and as long as sanctions are not putting pressure on those key members of the ruling coalition, they are less likely to work. My suggestion is sanctions are unable to, or have not been able to, pressure those key elites within the ruling coalition is because the North Korean leadership has been able to isolate its key supporters from the adverse effect of sanctions. So what the regime has done over the years is to offer selective inducements or positive private goods and selective rewards to those in charge of the country in exchange for loyalty, right? So some of the well-known examples of how regime has been able to buy loyalty is to offer residency to those key members of elite in Pyongyang, and the regime has been able to offer them better and more food. And even the regime allows key elites to get involved in some of these illicit activities, such as smuggling and some other activities, to be able to keep them happy, to be able to keep them within the ruling circle That means that over the years, there is no evidence that the sanctions against North Korea have any major impact on the small group of people that rule the country. And more importantly, it's even possible to argue that this group might have become more cohesive because they do benefit from sanctions through using the black market channels and through secured access to some of the positive rewards by the target leadership.
So we've heard a lot more lately. We hear things like targeted sanctions, secondary sanctions, things like that, trying to really get at those elites that you're talking about. Based on your research and your theory, is that a better option?
It's not necessarily a better option, but if sanctions ever work against North Korea, I would argue that we need to design sanctions that are aimed at the ruling elites, right? That's why selective sanctions are at least more appealing, more reasonable, and more logical to be able to put some pressure on the targeted elites. So if you look at the history of sanctions against North Korea, as I briefly mentioned earlier, in the post-Cold War era, they have been more smarter. That's what policymakers prefer to call them, or more selective. We had a number of sanctions that target the nuclear capabilities of the regime, like the sanctions on the exports of dual-use technologies and products that could be used for nuclear purposes. There have been a number of sanctions that are financial in nature that try to restrict the regime's ability to have access to hard currency and other revenues. And there have been also travel sanctions on certain elites and key members of the Kim coalition or Kim leadership. There have been also sanctions on the exports of luxury goods. So these are the types of sanctions that we call them selective, right? I don't think that they were more effective, or they were not necessarily very successful, but at least some of these financial sanctions and the bans on luxury goods put some pressure on the target elites. And more importantly, we avoided worsening already the dire conditions of average North Koreans.
How much of this, I guess, ineffectiveness would you say is also could also be due to the fact that the sanctions have not necessarily been universally enforced thus far?
Enforcement is a major issue, right? Sanctions are ineffective against North Korea or other countries in part because sanctions busting is a major concern. Right. It's hard to effectively enforce sanctions unless you have full cooperation from all the major sanctioning countries. Right. This is a major concern for multilateral sanctions, like the UN sanctions against North Korea. The UN has imposed a number of sanctions against North Korea. These sanctions are the selective types of sanctions that we were talking about earlier. But one of the challenges that the United Nations has is to maintain full cooperation among the sanctioning countries. Right. One well-known example is the ineffectiveness of sanctions on the exports of luxury goods, right? These sanctions were initially imposed in 2006 by the United Nations Security Council. All these major sanctioning countries agreed to, you know, selectively target the elites of the Kim regime to induce or to discourage them developing advanced nuclear weapons. But the sanctions on luxury goods were not too effective, in part because sanctioning countries were not even able to agree on what comprised of luxury goods, right? The Chinese came up with their own list of luxury goods. The Russians had a different idea whether or not certain products should be on this list. And Americans have their own take on what luxury goods look like. So this example does suggest that, you know, it's hard to sort of find a common ground among sanctioning countries so that they will be able to effectively enforce these sanctions, right? Because there are a lot of state as well as private actors in especially neighboring countries of sanctioned countries, like in the case of North Korea, China is probably a good example, that there are some private actors who will be willing to breach or bust these sanctions because it's profitable. They will make more money, they will generate more revenue for themselves, hence they are more inclined to bust them than cooperate with the sanctioning countries.
One other thing that caught my ear, I guess if you can say it like that, when you were talking earlier, was the idea that a lot of people make this argument that sanctions just take time. Give it time, they'll work. We just haven't given it enough time for them to be effective. And you disagree with that. Can you talk about your theory there?
Sure. I would argue the opposite. I think that if sanctions ever work, maybe they will be able to work in the first few years, right? My take on on the duration of sanctions is that the longer sanctions are in place, the easier for the target regimes to adjust their economies, right? They will find ways to seek alternative economic sort of channels to be able to mitigate the cost of sanctions. So the immediate external shocks that sanctions may inflict on the target country would probably induce some changes if they ever do.
Another thing that I think we end up talking a lot about is sanctions that are specifically targeting either the nuclear program or some of these provocations. North Korea launches a missile test and then we sanction them. But lately, I would say the last few years, especially after the UN Commission of Inquiry report, we've been talking a lot more about North Korean human rights and potentially sanctioning them based on human rights. The U.S. sanctions, for example, mention a lot of things about the human rights situation. Is that any better in terms of trying to accomplish a certain goal using sanctions?
So, sanctions are used for a number of reasons. As you suggested, the adverse human rights conditions in North Korea also sort of triggered more sanctions or more demands for sanctions in the international community to punish the Kim regime. But I don't think that the goal of sanctions itself has any impact, right? If sanctions are used to promote human rights, I could tell that from my own research that they tend to not work, right? On the contrary, existing research suggests that human rights sanctions are as counterproductive as non-proliferation sanctions or other types of sanctions, right? The reason for that is that the issue at stake for sanctioning countries is, yes, level of respect for human rights in the target countries, like in the case of North Korea. But for the regime, for the target regime itself, it's not about human rights abuses. It's about regime survival. They have more intention, or they are more inclined to actually resort to repression when they face this external pressure to make sure that their public, their winning coalition, their ruling coalition, others understand that they will never give in to external pressure, right? If they undertake the necessary human rights reforms that sanctioning countries demand, that will make them look really weak in their domestic politics. Hence, they actually are unlikely to give in to pressure for human rights purposes.
So we've looked at a lot of different ways that sanctions could be used, and it seems like, based on your research, that maybe they're not so effective. So, of course, now I have to ask you, what do we do if we can't use sanctions?
I'm not suggesting that sanctions should not be used, right? I think that the non-proliferation sanctions, economic sanctions on the export of dual-use technologies and other products used for nuclear purposes could still be used, right? We just should not have ambitious goal of political regime change and denuclearization, right? Or in the case of non-proliferation sanctions, they could at least slow down the regime's ability to develop advanced nuclear weapons, right? In the case of financial sanctions, we could somehow restrict the regime's ability to have access to hard currency. That's itself as a success, right? But it's unlikely that all of these sanction regimes that we impose will immediately achieve some ambitious goals of regime change and non-proliferation. Sanctions may achieve some modest goals, but they are not the right tool, in my opinion, under most circumstances to achieve some policy changes such as regime transition or denuclearization.
Right, that's interesting. It seems then that the problem is less how do we tweak sanctions to work better, but how do we tweak our expectations based on those sanctions?
I think so. What we want to achieve is as important as what types of tools that we use. But if you look at the universe of sanction cases, right, for the past 60, 70 years, right, we know that there is some consensus, at least among scholars, that sanctions oftentimes fail. So some claim that the success rate of sanctions is somewhere between 65 to 95%. Right. So what we are saying is that we should know that next time when we initiate another sanction regime is that the success rate is not in our favor. Right. It's more likely to fail than to achieve its intended goals. Sanctions perhaps could be used along with other tools. Right. Sort of a carrot stick strategy, a mixed strategy could be perhaps an option. If you impose sanctions against a regime, maybe you could generate some incentives for them to come to the table and agree with some of the expectations that you have from them, right? And more importantly, our engagement policy should target the every citizens in countries like North Korea rather than the regime, right? Engagement with the regime will benefit the regime only. If we find ways to expose the targeted citizens to the rest of the world, it may generate some opposition against the target regime, and it may also help us achieve the intended goals of sanctions and other tools that sanctioning countries or major powers use.
Great. So we've talked a lot about the sanctions regime. We've had a really great discussion that I think is a topic that people talk about a lot, but you talk about it in a very direct and from an interesting perspective. So I really appreciate that. To wrap up, is there anything else you think people need to know about sanctions in North Korea?
Well, one thing is clear that the sanctions are unlikely to achieve at least officially stated goals, right? So what are those goals? I could come up with three major goals that drive at least sanctions, in my opinion. Regime change, denuclearization, and reunification of two Koreas, right? I would argue that economic sanctions will not achieve any of these goals, but it could at least, some of the sanction cases, especially some of these selective sanctions, could at least help us contain the military aggression, most especially the non-proliferation sanctions. Some of these secondary financial sanctions could also perhaps hurt the government's access to some of the financial resources that could be used in its nuclear program. So sanctions could still be used, but oftentimes I don't think that they will be too effective against North Korea.
Not necessarily a positive note to end on, but we'll end there nonetheless. Thank you very much for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Korean Context. As always, please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts. And remember that you can always go back and listen to our previous episodes at keia.podbean.com. Thank you again for joining us, and we'll see you next week.